Assalamualaikum. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Alhamdulillah rabbil alamin. Wassallallahu ala Muhammad wa ala alihi tahirin.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala
alihi. When discussing holy personalities in Islam, scientists of different sciences within Islam, they give a commentary and description of those holy personalities depending on the principles of that particular science. Each particular science, each particular Islamic science, has its own way and approach and methodology in giving a commentary and describing holy figures. When it comes to Lady Khadija alayhi salam, or Lady Fatima alayhi salam, sometimes historians and some theologians, they give a very superficial description, which is necessary. But that superficial nature, that zahiri nature, is a result of the methodology and their own principles. History is about who married who, how many children, what happened when. And that's what a historian does. But we see that in relation to Lady Khadija, for example, historians have a lot of differences of opinion. For example, how old was she at the time of marriage? There are differing opinions. Another source of difference in relation to Lady Khadija alayhi salam is whether she had children other than Lady Fatima alayhi salam. And here we see here too, there are many differences of opinion amongst the historians. But since history isn't a definitive science and it doesn't lead to certainty on its own, and it has a wide range of principles through which it interprets history, this is only a natural result of such a science, to get differing opinions and differing positions on one issue. So in relation to Lady Khadija alayhi salam, there are many different understandings in relation to how many children she had with the Prophet or in marriages before the Prophet, or some of the children were her sister's children, and it was a Arab custom that if one sister passes away, the children are passed on to the other sister. There are many different positions here. However, when it comes to Irfan and the Urafa, who have their own principles, for them, it's impossible that Lady Khadija, the mother of Lady Fatima, the owner of the womb which procreated Lady Fatima alayhi salam, it's impossible, according to Irfani principles, that such a woman married or had children before. And therefore, according to them, they side with those historians who say Lady Khadija alayhi salam only had one marriage, one child, which was Lady Fatima alayhi salam, with that one marriage with the Holy Messenger sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. Well, why is it they have such an opinion? This goes back to the concept of the womb, the concept of the uterus in Irfan, the role that the uterus has in shaping humanity in general and one's offspring in particular. The uterus or the womb has many meanings in Islam. That meaning which we intend is this biological womb. Otherwise, there are many other meanings for the womb. One meaning is the dunya is the womb. Whatever thing that through means of which something is cultivated and generated, in Islam we call that a womb. And therefore the dunya is also a womb, because people are being cultivated here. We're being brought up here most of our lives. Our salvation, our fate is tied as a result of how we are being produced moment to moment in this dunya. And this has many repercussions, this understanding of the womb when it's the dunya. In environmental issues, this has a lot of important repercussions. But in this discussion today and tomorrow, inshallah, we're discussing the biological womb. Now, since, according to the Ulama, there's a unity between the body and the soul, and inshallah we'll talk more about this tomorrow, but what we mean, it's one reality, it's one me, but this me has a number of dimensions, it's multidimensional. This very me that has an earthly, worldly dimension, but also has immaterial dimensions. But there's a unity between them. So if one dimension, if certain things happen to it, it can have an effect on our other dimensions, and vice versa. If you become physically ill, it has an effect on your spirit. If you become spiritually ill, it has an effect on your body, and so on and so forth. It's one reality. Now, when it comes to the question of women, the soul of the woman, when we want to see what is the essence and where does the identity of the soul of women lie in, and this is very important, the same question arises with men, because the soul also has sex, male and female. The body also has sex, male and female. The reason we say the soul has sex is because of that unity between body and spirit. The I doesn't have sex or gender. That is sexless, genderless. But the soul, no, that has it. So here, the female soul and the male soul, yes, they're both immaterial, but the essence and identity of each differs. So that we have to understand what is the identity of the male and female soul. Once we answer that, a lot of the ahkam in the Sharia is based on this reality. Because the Sharia is the letter of the law. But this letter of the law is dependent upon, is based upon, is secondary to the batin of the law, the esoteric dimensions of the law. Now, what is the essence of the female soul? Because of the principle of unity between body and soul, the answer is that look at the physical body, see what is specific to the female, and then you'll have an idea of the identity and that which is specific to the essence of the female soul. And when it comes to the female, one of the most important things that we see in the physical realm of the female body that is specific to females, it's the womb. The womb, the uterus. And this physical, biological uterus, its role is generating and nurturing the offspring for, let's say, 9 months. As a result of this, we see that the essence of the woman is that she is a nurturer by essence. And this is a very important principle. Because what started off as a single cell embryo, after 9 months, it's a 3 to 3.5 kilogram child. Where did this child come from? The woman is existentially nurturing this child. The woman is generating the child. This concept of generation, inshallah, I'll go into more detail tomorrow. But the mother is generating and nurturing. Whatever she is thinking, all her actions, all her thoughts, all her earnings, all the actions that are emanating from her, all her intentions, all these are shaping the child, has an effect on the child. The same applies to the father too, but to a much lesser degree. The same even applies to one's grandparents to a lesser degree. It even applies to one's ancestors. Your ancestors' thoughts, your ancestors' actions. We believe in spiritual genetics. We have many traditions which highlight this. It's not as if generations are mutually exclusive from one another. They're responsible, and this spirituality is passed on from generation to generation. And also, in the concept of infallibility, ismat, when we speak of people being born ma'soom, it's because this being born ma'soom is different to preserving one's ismat and infallibility. Being born ma'soom is a product of one's previous parents, grandparents, and so on and so forth. Preserving one's ismat is one's own endeavor. But parents with pure thoughts, pure actions, grandparents, pure thoughts, pure actions, pure intentions, this leads to an offspring of purity. And that's what we mean by ma'soom, when someone is born ma'soom. Because of this process. And when one is born purely, they don't need an ustad, a mentor, a teacher, and so on and so forth. The angels guide them. Because angels are a function of one's purity. But with me and you, with X and Y parents and grandparents and so forth, degrees of impurity step in. And that prevents us being guided by angels. The mother is the nurturer. She nurtures the child. And this is a very important role. She's shaping the child in 9 months. These 9 months are maybe more important than the 90 years that child will have in this dunya. How did the 9 months pass by during gestation? There's a hidden principle amongst the urafa. They say, you give me the first 9 months of gestation, I will tell you what will happen in the next 90 years of the child. These are important equations. And that's why the mother, during gestation, she has to be very careful. The husband has to be very careful. Moment to moment, action to action, they're shaping, they're nurturing, they're molding an offspring. So she's a nurturer. The essence of a woman is that she's a nurturer. And this is so important in Islam, that a lot of rulings in the Sharia are based on this reality, that she is a nurturer. And I want to go, with your permission, through some of these rulings. Just before I do, just one hadith I wanted to mention. Because when she is nurturing the woman as a nurturer, she's a manifestation of Allah's attributes, Ar-Rabb and Ar-Rahman. The woman manifests Allah's rububiyyah, lordship, nurturing. Rab is a nurturer. We translate it as Lord, but the Rab is the cherisher, the nurturer. The woman manifests this attribute of Allah more than men. The woman manifests Allah's Rahmaniyah more than men. There are some attributes that men, some divine attributes that men manifest more than women. But there are some attributes that women manifest more than men. In relation to what the essence of the male soul is, that deals with other things. But now we're focusing on the woman here. She manifests Allah's rububiyyah and rahmaniyyah in a manner much more than men can manifest. Not that men do not nurture and have no rahmaniyyah. No, they also have it. But the women, they manifest it much more. There's a sacred tradition where Allah says, Anallah wa anar Rahman. I am Allah, I am Rahman. And they're all the universally merciful. Merciful since pre-eternity to post-eternity to all beings, irrespective of what or who they are. Anallah, I am Allah. Wa ana ar-Rahman khalaqatu ar-Rahima, I created the womb. Wa shaqaqatu laha isman min ismi, and I derived its name from one of my names, which is Rahman. Rahim, the womb, is a manifestation of Rahman. It's a manifestation of Allah's rububiyyah. It was extracted from this attribute of Allah. Then the tradition continues. وَمَنْ وَسَلَهَا وَسَلْتُهُ. Whoever connects to the womb, I'll connect with them. وَمَنْ قَتَعَهَا. But whoever disconnects and abandons the womb, قَتَعْتُهُ. I'll abandon them. I'll disconnect from them. Now here, womb, all applications of the womb apply. The biological womb, it has to be respected, it has to be connected with. The rites during gestation, you have to abide by them. If you don't abide by the rites of the fetus during gestation, Allah will abandon you. Also, womb means the dunya. You have to treat the environment properly. If you don't, Allah will abandon you. This just highlights the importance of the womb. Whatever is a cultivator, biological womb, the physical dunya, and other things which qualify as a womb, it has a high degree. It has a high position, high status in Islam. Why? Because it's a manifestation of Allah's Rahmaniyya. So, the woman, as a nurturer, with the being a owner of the womb, as a nurturer, she's reflecting this attribute of Allah. And the Sharia acknowledges this reality and gives a lot of rulings based on this reality. The Sharia is not satisfied, and Allah is not satisfied, if the woman's nurturing capacity is compromised. What does that mean? Now, the woman is a nurturer. Nurturing doesn't have to mean We don't have to solely confine nurturing to bringing up children. That is one very important application of nurturing. But also a female teacher, architect, doctor, and so on and so forth, they can also nurture. Whatever they do, they have to nurture them. But yes, maybe the most important misdaad of nurturing is nurturing an offspring. But if a woman wants to work in society, Islam gives the go-ahead. The choice is hers. That which Islam is sensitive to is whatever you do, your nurturing capacity shouldn't be compromised. So if a woman wants to work 9 to 5 every day, this may be a chore upon her. This may be a burden upon her. Without a doubt, Islam wouldn't like that. It's not on a par with what Islam would like. It's not haram for a woman to work 9 to 5. But ethically, spiritually, if one compromises one's nurturing capacity because of the chores one undergoes at work, that's not liked in Islam. And this, one has to be careful, because once the nurturing capacity of the woman is broken or is compromised, that woman, when her nurturing capacity is compromised, the children's upbringing will be compromised, the family environment will be compromised, and in the end, society at large will be compromised. So we're not saying that women have to have X, Y, Z particular job, or they have to stay home, no. But whatever she wants to do, she has to make sure she doesn't compromise her nurturing capacity. And the husband also has a spiritual responsibility to make sure that doesn't happen. And maybe that's why, when we come to the wajibat of women, what is obligatory and mandatory for women, here Islam, when it comes to what is wajib in relation to the husband, and what does the woman have to do for the husband on a wajib level, here Islam only gives two things, two very little things. For the man, Islam gives 101 things under the umbrella of the nafaqah. But for the woman, it's only two little things. Why does Islam give 101 wajib duties for the man? It goes back to what the essence of the male soul is. Why does Islam only give 2 wajib duties for the woman? It goes back to, because she's a nurturer. Don't chore her. Don't burden her. Let her be free. If the woman is let to be free, she will manifest that nurturing capacity maximally. But if the woman is told, do this, do that, and so on and so forth, go to work, don't do this, don't do that, that nurturing capacity will be compromised, the woman will break, family will break, community will break, society will break. Now look at this next tradition, which highlights this reality in a very delicate way. إِنَّهُ مَثَلُ الْمَرْآ مَثَلُ ذِلَّ الْمُؤْوَاجِ. It sounds a bit medieval at first, but once I explain it, inshallah, it's more, it's become more evident. Verily, the example of the woman is the example of the curved rib bone. You know, our ribs, they're curved. It's comparing the woman to a curved rib bone. In aqamtahu kasartahu. With the rib bone, if you straighten it, it'll break. The rib bone will break. وَإِن تَرَكْتَهُ إِسْتَمْتَعْتَ بِهِ. But if you let it be, abandon the rib bone, you'll benefit from it. You can breathe normally and so on and so forth. If you want to straighten the rib bone, the rib bone will break. If you let it be, you'll benefit from it. Up to here, it was about the rib bone. And then it ends with a simple prescription. Ismir alayha. Be patient with them, women. Let them be. Don't try to straighten them. If you straighten them, they'll break. Let them be. Because she is, by essence, a nurturer, if you just let her be, she will do nothing but nurture. But she has to want to do that. But if she's always burdened with these responsibilities, it will be a hindrance to that nurturing capacity. And so Islam only gives two little duties, wajib duties for the woman. And it's interesting that even those two, she only has to do them if the poor man has to actually succeeds to accomplish those 101 wajib duties. If the man fails, let's say 20% or 30% in his duties, the woman can avoid doing those two, 20 or 30% respectively, in proportion to how the man fulfills his duties. So the point is, why is the woman so free? She's a nurturer. Don't break her. That's one issue. The other issue is other rulings in the Sharia. One is the concept of jihad. When Muslims, in the name of Islam, to protect Islam, to spread Islam, they start the holy war, or they're defending in a war. This jihad, women don't have to go. Men have to go. It's wajib. For the woman, it's not wajib. The woman can go if she wants. It's not haram if she goes, but it's not a wajib. Why isn't it wajib? Because she's a nurturer. If you take a nurturer to the battlefield, to the battlefront, this goes against her essence. It may compromise her nurturing capacity. Islam says no, there's no need. Don't force her. Or for example, in Friday prayers, it's good if the woman goes. It's a good thing, it's not bad, especially if her intentions are good. And she will get thawab if she goes. But there's no insistence for her to go by the Sharia. If she wants to go, she can go. Otherwise, she doesn't go. With men, there's an emphasis. Go to Friday prayer. With women, we don't have this emphasis. Why? Let her be free. Let her be free. If she wants it, there's no confining her to a given time, that she has to be present here. But for men, there is such an emphasis. Or going to court, for example. If a man has evidence and can give testimony in a court, it's wajib that he goes and provides that evidence to the judge. One man has evidence, that one man has to go to court. He can't refrain from giving that evidence. People's lives, people's dignity is at stake. He has to go. But for women, the Sharia says no, she doesn't have to go. If there are two women with evidence, okay, then yes, let them go. But when there's one, there's no need. Don't take her to court. Why? Because she's a nurturer. What she will see in the court place, it's not on a par with her nurturing capacity. Even though many cases may not be solved, Islam regards that nurturing capacity, and it's not being compromised, more important than a certain number of cases not being solved. But if there are two women with evidence, let them go. Or for example, with divorce, women are not given the automatic right to divorce. Although at the time of the contract, they can be given the power of attorney by the man to the woman, that she can divorce herself from the man whenever she wants or under certain conditions. For example, she can stipulate, if you ever take drugs or do X action or Y action, I want the power of attorney from you that I divorce myself from you if these actions happen. Or even in the absolute sense, that power of attorney can be given. But it's not given automatically to the woman. Why? Because divorcing, إِنَّ التَّلَاغَى يَحْتَزُّ مِنْهُ الْعَرْشِ. Verily, divorce shakes the throne. The throne is the heart, the place where Allah's attributes are manifesting. Divorce cripples one's spirituality. Men should not divorce. Women should not use that right, assuming they have it. It's only a last resort. Yes, if that last resort is there, it's okay. Men should not withdraw divorce in the woman when they see that they're oppressing the woman. If the woman is being oppressed and the man says, I'm not going to divorce you, and that just increases the woman's oppression, being oppressed, no, that's not right. At the end of the day, divorce is there for a reason. But it's a very last resort. You should do everything possible before a divorce is actualized. Any divorce that happens within a year, within 2 years, 3 years, there are exceptions, but this shows that the people, the spouses, the families, they didn't put an effort into it. Otherwise, a divorce within a year or two, it has no meaning. But why isn't divorce given to her automatically? Because divorcing cripples one's spirituality. You can't divorce. And it's not on a par with a nurturer to commit such a crippling of spirituality. But if she wants it, the right can be given. In relation to being a judge, although the majority of religious authorities in Islam, they say women can't be judges. One or two of the maraji, they accept that they can be. Such as Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli, hafadahullah. There, even in, and he uses traditions too. I didn't find it, I have recited this tradition before, but I didn't have it with me to recite for you. I wanted to recite the Arabic. The Arabic gives a number of actions in that tradition where it says, there's no Friday prayer, there's no visiting of the ill, there's no this, there's no that, and there's no being a judge for women. And then some scholars say, look, all these are, it's, they don't have to do it. But if they want, they can do it. But this responsibility doesn't lie on their shoulders when it does upon the shoulders of men. The woman is, the man is wajib to be a judge if society needs it. For women, it's not wajib. Although, as I say, the majority of religious scholars don't accept that women can be judges. And the reasons are fiqh in nature. But those which do, yes, this is one reason that even here, being a judge, you don't have to be a judge if you're a woman. Why? Because being a judge is not on a par with your nurturing capacity. In being a judge, passing the penalty, passing the sentence, that he has to be hung, he has to be lashed, he has to be imprisoned, he has to be like this, he has to be like that. It's not on a par with the nurturing capacity of the woman. And therefore there's no insistence for them to be judges. The woman's nurturing capacity should not be compromised. That is the universal equation. Now every woman, we don't need to judge them, every woman knows herself best and they can come to their own course of action. Okay, and finally, Imam Khomeini, just to support everything that has been said here, he has, in his speeches, I've two extracts from his speeches, which I want to read out. These are my own translations. They're not perfect, but the message is conveyed. In the first extract, he says, "The woman is a grand human being, society's nurturer. Humans are discovered from the laps of women. After all, she is the educator of humankind. The prosperity and wretchedness of a given society depends on the existence and status of women." You see, in every society, see what the status of women are, is. The higher the status of the woman, the more she can manifest her nurturing capacity, the more prosperity that society will have. The less this nurturing capacity is manifested in a society, the more wretched the fate of that society will be. And without a doubt, in the West, and also in the East, just that in the East it's happening at a slower rate, but we see it in the East too, there's definitely a marketization, a commodification of women. They're used as commodities. They're used as mere tools for the advertising industry, the beauty industry. Whatever society where this grows, this aspect of the woman, where she's used more and more as a commodity, that society sooner or later will see its downfall. Then he continues, by correctly educating herself, she educates humans. And by correctly educating herself, she frees nations. The source of all prosperities emanates and springs from her lap. This from her lap, she's a nurturer. The woman must be the source of all prosperities. That's one part. And finally, in this speech, the value of a single night of the mother with the child surpasses years of the responsible father's efforts. This is a true Arif speaking. Only an Arif can speak like that. We don't have Orafa like Imam Khomeini. Unfortunately, because of the propaganda that we have today in the whole world, it'll take maybe a century before we can now freely think and discover who this man was. I'm not exaggerating at all. In every society there has been propaganda, but in every society there are people who have recognized who Imam Khomeini was. In every society. In Lebanon, Imam Khomeini may have been assassinated his character to some degree, but there were always people who knew who he was, and therefore the Khomeini line continued there. In Afghanistan, maybe Imam Khomeini was assassinated, his personality, whatever reason, but there were always movements in Afghanistan, and they knew who the real Imam Khomeini was. People like Abdul Hamid Sajidi and others. In every society, there's always been people. But it takes time because of the propaganda for it to be dissolved. It'll take time. Some societies sooner than others. Look at this statement. Who can give such a statement? That a single night, the value of a single night of the mother with the child, its value surpasses. And the mother doesn't have to be a practicing mother either. But she's a mother. It surpasses years of the responsible father's efforts. Responsible father's efforts. Years. Because this manifestation of Allah's rububiyyah and rahmaniyyah is much more than in the man. The embodiment of affection and mercy in the mother's luminous outlook is the manifestation of the mercy and affection of the Lord of all worlds, Rabbul Alameen. She's a manifestation of Rabbul Alameen. The Almighty Allah has blended the mother's heart and soul with the light of mercy of His Rububiyyah to the extent that it can't be identified anywhere save within the mother. And Allah has granted this eternal mercy to them for their heaven-breaking burdens from the time of conception, during gestation, during labor, during birth, and so on. The noble hadith that reads, "Heaven lies under the mother's feet," is referring to a reality. Such delicate wording is emphasizing the mightiness of the matter, as well as warning children of the fact that that they should seek prosperity and heaven from beneath the mother's feet. What does that mean? And that they should observe the mother's sanctity as they observe Allah's, and that they should seek their immaculate Lord's satisfaction through the satisfaction of their mothers. Sallallahu alaihi wa sallam.